You're listening to Band Geek with Richie Castellano on the Riotcast Network. Riotcast.com.
Hey guys, Richie here. This is Band Geek episode 47. Our guest today is my uncle, Phil Castellano. My uncle is a man of many talents. He's a musician. He plays bass and guitar and he sings. He actually taught me how to play bass. And I owe him a lot because he taught me how to do a lot of things. He was the person that gave me my first recording equipment. He got me into hard rock like Queen, Yes, even the Beatles. I have to give him credit for that. And we're going to talk about that in the episode. But aside from being a great musician and one of my primary musical influences, my uncle does a lot of other things, too. He's also an actor, and he's been in several Hollywood movies. And you could probably spot him in a few of the movies we're going to talk about today. He's also an electrical genius. He can build anything from a house to a radio. He was a child prodigy in a lot of ways, and we're also going to discuss that and how, at an early age, he used to tinker and build things and disassemble family appliances. So we have a lot of cool things to talk about in that regard. And he's also a guitar builder and a guitar luthier. He built two of the basses that I frequently use, including the bass I use with Blue Oyster Cult. So he's a really interesting guy. And from the get-go, when I did this podcast, in the back of my mind, I always knew I wanted to have him on because I knew the Band Geek listeners we're going to get a big kick out of all the stories he has to tell. He's a really funny guy. He's brilliant, and he's very interesting, and I think you're going to like this. Joining us on this episode is my uncle's longtime bandmate, Tino Cacciolo. Great drummer. He plays drums in my dad's band with my uncle. That band is called Good and Plenty, and they've been together for decades. And, you know, I remember when I was a little kid sitting in on their band rehearsals, and that's where I learned a lot about how to be a musician and how to work with other people. Please support Band Geek by using our Amazon link. So you go to www.riotcast.com/bandgeek. At the top of the page, you'll see the Amazon banner. Click that banner before you do your Amazon shopping, and a small percentage of your purchase goes to support our show. Doesn't cost you anything, and it's a huge help to us. So please do that, and please continue to do that if you have been doing it. We really appreciate it. Band Geek Live. I'm so stoked for this show. This is going to be at Katie's in Smithtown, New York, and that's on July 19th. Let me double check, make sure that's the right date. Yes, July 19th. It's a Sunday. We're starting at 8 o'clock, 8 p.m., and we have a lot of fun things planned and really awesome special guests. This is going to be really cool. It's sort of like the best of Band Geek, but with some new surprises. So, this is going to be a really fun time. So if you're in the New York area, come on down. We have giveaways and a lot of fun things. It's going to be crazy. It's basically a live podcast. So you're going to be in the room with us as we screw around. And what's better than that? So here we go. I hope you enjoy episode 47, Uncle Phil. This week on Band Geek, this is going to be really cool, or not. No, this is going to be
this is going to be a very special Band Geek.
It's going to make a big explosion.
No, I'm Richie Castellano. This is Band Geek. With me today is my co-host Jarrett Pressman.
What's happening, babies?
On the keyboard today is Andy Escalise. Now, Andy, we've gotten the new drums, and you haven't gotten to play them yet.
I still haven't.
This is like the second month of me having these new drums, and you haven't played them yet.
It's like the third. I think you've had them for a while.
Joining us in the studio today is Brandy Metaxas.
Hello.
On drums, doing us a huge, huge solid today, Mr. Tino Cacciola. Woo! Yeah. And the guest of honor in the hot seat is Uncle Phil. Hi, Uncle Phil.
Your mother said I had to be here. You know that.
Just talk closer to the mic.
Your mother said I had a beard.
Uncle Phil is my Uncle Phil.
His first name is Uncle.
Yeah. Phil Castellano, my uncle, my father's brother. You've heard my father's episode. And now, you might think that just because my dad's nuts from listening to his episode, that my uncle would be nuts. And you'd be correct. That is a true assumption to think that. But
a smidgen. Tiny little drop.
But one, Uncle Phil is one of the most interesting people I know. One of my biggest influences in life, and a great musician, and he has tons of cool stories. And I thought, when I was thinking about doing the podcast, you know, if we first started, and I had a list of people I wanted to get on, you were definitely on there, because I said, Uncle Phil will kill this. This will be awesome. And we're going to talk a lot, and we're going to play some music, too, and I'm sure we're going to pull some stuff out of our asses. But,
no pressure. Not a drop.
Normally for the Castellano,
normally
for the Castellanos, things coming out of the asses is not really difficult. But today,
oh.
Hey, talk to your mic for a second, Uncle. I want to get.
I shall talk into my mic, Richie. How close do you want me to put it?
I'll just make sure.
My gain?
Yeah. Okay.
It's a gain.
A bit. Talk.
Hello, hello, hello.
There you are.
That's really buzzy.
That's buzzy. All right. So just.
This is my interview.
Just let's get talk you, right into
let's
it.
Let's get you up on it.
I'll talk right. Oh, I'll lean in.
Yeah, there you go.
Reminds me of a girl I knew. I lean in.
So before we jump into the whole this is your life thing, now I want to talk about Tino also. You guys have been playing together for how long?
Forever. A long
40 40 plus
a long,
years.
Long time. 40 plus.
40 plus years.
Now, when did you guys meet?
Well, we met at an anniversary party, right?
Your mom's.
My mom's anniversary party.
On King's Highway.
25th anniversary Chinese
Top
restaurant.
Of the Chinese restaurant.
And Joey Ardigo. Sat in and played with Joey Ardigo and your father.
Now, who's Joey Ardigo?
Joey Ardigo is probably one of the most enjoyable entertainers and a very prolific songwriter and a very good entertainer. Unfortunately, the world hasn't discovered him yet. He's got some really beautiful songs, too. So it's like we're all undiscovered talent, Rich. You know what I'm saying?
I think you're mixing those two up. Check 1, 2, 2, 2.
What do you think? It's you?
Hello.
No, I hear it buzzy when you turn Uncle Phil up, too.
Oh, wait. Andy's right. Hold on.
Check 1, 2.
Uh-huh. I go. See, said the blind man.
Check 1, 2.
I have gained the gain. Okie dokie.
Technical difficulty, stand by.
Check 1, 2, 2, 2. Hey, 2, 1, 1, 2.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yes.
I have fixed your doorbell from the ringing.
There's your voice. So you guys met at my grandmother's anniversary party?
Yeah, grandma had a 25th anniversary at a Chinese restaurant upstairs, and at the time, your father's doing a I didn't really play the bass guitar. I was too busy being a fool. And Joe Ardigo was playing bass guitar with your dad, and this young kid came along, Tino Cacciola, and he sat in on drums, and he smoked it. I mean, it was really, really good. And I looked at these guys and said, this is a good band. This is very good. And that's how he began.
Now, how old were you at this point, Tino?
40 subtract from 60. 20. I was really young, man. Really young.
Now, when did you start playing drums?
I started playing at 8 when my uncle brought me a set of drums for my birthday, and my father said, take it back, because we lived in the housing projects.
Oh, yeah, right.
He knew the person that lived under us. Mrs. Duncan. That's
she made the yo-yo, right?
No, she played pipes.
Ah.
Every afternoon at 3:30 when I got home from school. And then I played in a marching band, St. Simon and Jude in Brooklyn.
Oh, so you're an actual band geek.
Wow. Hey. He is a band geek. Hey, wait a second. Does that qualify? I did the same thing in high school.
Were you in a marching band?
No, I played the cello in a marching band. It was very difficult I had to bring the stool with me. It was very difficult.
Richie, you have no idea what kind of a geek I am. Yeah. You know, when you play music, and at that young age, you're looking for identity. You're looking to, find some place where you fit. And
I still don't.
And
fit,
I, right,
you know,
I didn't fit no place else.
I'm 60 now. I don't fit
but
anyway.
But behind a set of pot covers and my drums, because we couldn't afford the cymbals yet, so I used the cast iron pot covers, my mom's. That's where I found my identity, and that's where it all started. So, eight years old and. That's when I started, and then I started playing with a couple of bands, and then through Teresa, Fofi's cousin, That's how I found
Foofy
you.
Is code for Uncle Phil.
That's code. Geek code for
Here's something. I'll give a little bit of a trivia really quick just for context.
Okay.
We have a lot of Blue Oyster Cult fans who listen to this show. When I joined Blue Oyster Cult, I had a yellow bass, a five-string yellow bass. That bass is called the Foof.
Nice.
The reason that bass is called the Foof is because my Uncle Phil, codename Foof, he basically built that thing. So
this is true.
So that's why that bass is called the Foof, and that's his name is Foof. So there you go, context.
That's how I know him.
Yeah. Oh well, I got to tell a lot of friends of mine call me that by the nickname Foof, but nobody realizes why. We had little cousins that couldn't pronounce the word Philip, and it would come out like Foof, and hence I got the name 60 years ago when I was a baby. And all my other cousins would do it. And you know what? It doesn't offend me. Guys look at me at work and they go, oh, we'll call you Foof.
Yeah. It sounds like exasperation. Like,
Don't feel bad. I was called Roofhead. Yeah, when it rained, everyone got underneath me. You know, let's stay dry.
That's funny.
Yeah, real funny.
I like Foof better, though.
Yeah.
So, Tino, you played in a band with Joey Ardigo, who we just mentioned, who's a singer-songwriter who was playing bass.
Yes.
And my dad on guitar. And, right. And it was a three-piece?
Yeah, me, Joey, yep. and your yep. dad.
And then did you get the sax player next? Larry, was that the next? Or was the keyboard player next?
You know, I left your dad about 3 or 4 times.
Okay.
I said, I'm done. But, you know, I got to come back because I love your father.
I left him 3 or 4 times this week. This but, week, I left him 3 or 4 times. Easily.
But I didn't leave him for another band. I just left to find other things in my life.
You know, you just stimulated my brain in there. You know, when he
I'm
left.
I'm sorry.
When he left, now that I remember it, when he left, Joey Ardigo moved over to drums, and I sat in with your father at Steak and Blue.
Steak and Blue.
Yeah,
right. Well,
that's
yeah.
wishful thinking. at Steak and Brew,
a few times when we play.
I did a song, and your father looked at me and goes, God, he can play the bass. And I said, yeah, John, what do you think? I sat in a shop all day long not doing it? So that's how I got an asset.
That's different from the way he tells that story.
My mother made me bring my little brother to gigs.
And now I have to drag my older brother to gigs.
Uh-huh. You know, I almost feel bad that he's not here today to do this, but we're doing a Genesis song today, and that wouldn't fly with my father.
No, he's not really sure who Genesis is.
You think he's talking about the Bible.
In the beginning, there was Peter Gabriel.
But you know what's funny? My uncle is he's a hardcore, you know, 70s English rock fan. You know what I mean? Like as hardcore as you could get. And then because he was in my dad's band for a good part of his life, he only got to play American R&B. You know what I mean? Like his whole life. So when we're getting ready for this podcast, he goes, I said, so what songs do you like to play? He goes, oh, we'll do, you know, Ain't No Stopping Us Now. Well, maybe we'll do some Motown. I said, Uncle Phil, you've been talking for my whole life about how all you want to play is rock music, and you have an opportunity, and you say, hey, let's do some disco or some R&B.
But I did call out some crazy rock and roll tunes.
Yes, you did.
I did call out Heart of the Sunrise. I said, let's do Heart of the Sunrise from Yes. And we said, no.
we did it on a show already.
We did, yeah.
Not in its entirety, but I was trying to be nice to everybody. That's a toughie.
Yeah. Actually, let me clarify something here. Your father might have said my mother wanted me. But wait a second. You just put a burn in my head here. You know what it was?
What?
My mother also told me to watch out for my brother.
That's right.
I was a little brother, but I used to lift weights and I was like a crazy kid too. So my parents would always say, they played. I just realized, Mom, Dad, I hate you. You played us both against each other. I'm only kidding, Mom, Dad. I want to play it. But so, that's what it was, Rich.
Okay, so I want to talk about some early stuff because everybody has legends about their family that they hear. Like, do you know Grandpa used to do this? So
right,
you know that.
Right.
But I have some pretty crazy stories about my grandparents, and maybe we'll get to that one day. We'll have everybody sit down and record that.
Oh yeah.
But the stories I've heard about my uncle are legendary, and we're going to confirm some of them now. Now. All right, we're going to start off like this.
This could be a problem, you know.
So my uncle plays bass. Is an excellent bass player, taught me how to play bass. You know, he sings. He's also an actor. He's been in several films. He's also an engineer, an electrical engineer. Is that a?
That's pretty accurate.
He's a mechanic, and he's also a luthier. So he wears many hats.
Yeah.
So when so what came first for you? Were you tinkering first? Were you playing music first? What happened? Now I've heard legends of you being like 3 or 4 and disassembling the family TV.
Absolutely. Oh, well, I'll tell you something, Richard. You know what it was? I grew up in a house where my parents let me get away with murder. I mean, you name it, I can do it. I took stuff apart at a very, very, very young age, and I always put it back together, and it always worked, but there was always extra parts. What is the safety switch for? Don't worry, Mommy, you don't need it. It's okay.
You were the original IKEA.
Yeah, and I used to put stuff together with tape and scotch tape and glue. I remember one story, one time Pop came into my room. I was like 10, and he came into my room with a hammer, because he got the phone bill and it was like $100, and he seen I had like 12 different color trimline phones on my wall, and with a hammer he proceeded to claw hammer them off the wall.
Wait, rewind. Why did you have phones in your room? And what this is in the 50s or the 60s?
No, this I believe was the mid 60s.
Okay.
And well, I had phones in my room because I used to like taking the microphones apart and try and use them on speakers and play with them, mix and match the colors, and had a whole wall over there. I used to lay in my bed at night and I'd throw a switch on, my television would go on at the other end of the room. And I was a kid, Rich. I mean, I'm a little kid. Why I didn't burn down my house and blow up my family is beyond me. Let me tell you what. This is your father was there for this. I remember I was painting a guitar that Elvin Bishop ended up buying. And we had, this is so freaking stupid, I can't believe I did this. Mom, I apologize. I turned the stove on and made it nice and hot in the room as I was spraying lacquer.
What?
Oh, yeah. And I had mist in my mother's kitchen. And in retrospect, I look at it and say, meh. What a maroon. I could have killed my whole family. And I never told my mother that story, but your dad was there for that. And he was agreeing with me, going, "Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Make it warm in here, and the paint'll dry better. It'll dry much quicker." And little scenarios like that, Richie. I tell you, I feel like Jimmy Durant. I got a million of them. There was so many stupid things I did growing up.
What was the first thing you can remember, either disassembling or building or improving or making? Like, what's the first thing you can remember?
Do you really want me to? I'll tell you something that is going to sound really stupid, but this is the truth. If I'm lying, I shouldn't make it home tonight. I was about 7 years old, and I was building a train set in our room. Me and my brother, your dad, we lived in the same room. And I remember putting the switches in, and I couldn't get them to work. And I remember as clear as I can see now, thinking to myself, how did I used to do this? And I did it the way I remembered, and it worked. And I said, this is not right. This can't be. I was like a kid. I was like 7. I never touched that before. And I remember thinking clearly, how did I used to do this? And I said, oh, that's right. And I did it, and it worked. And from that day on, I said, you know what? Maybe I was inspired from a divine intervention somehow, you know. But I didn't make no money doing it, so.
All right, I'm going to confirm a few more legends here. I heard from, now, like you said, you and my dad shared a room. And my father was a bit antagonistic from what I understand, but we're going to get back to that in a second.
No. Was? You said was, right?
No, but he told me that maybe you were 13, you can confirm the age once I tell the story, but he said at one point you got tired of having to get up from your bed to turn the fan on or close the lights, so you had a control panel next to your bed.
Yes, this is true.
Is this true? Absolutely. How old were you when you did this?
10, 11, 12.
How fat were you when you were a little kid?
Listen, you know, you guys, we're all geeks and nerds. Yeah. I was the definitive nerd. I mean, all I wanted to do was play with trains and racing cars and DC motors. And I elevated into saying, if I could play with this, I could probably wire my mother's house. And I started playing with BX cables and stuff like that. All those stupid educations I learned as a child ended up paying me off in the late years. Because I went and worked. I worked, ended up doing that for a living.
Right now, my uncle works for, can I tell them where you work?
I work for the greatest business in the United States. I work for the U.S. Postal Service.
And he is an electrical engineer for them. Now, You don't realize.
Well,
this,
not really. You know, Richie, my different title now. I was supposed to be an maintenance engineering specialist, but now I became a vehicle a manager of vehicle maintenance for the borough.
Okay.
So it's a different title.
But when you think about the postal service, you don't realize that the machines they use to sort the mail are really advanced, because these are machines that are reading handwriting. Right. You know what I mean? And
in any language.
Yeah, in any language. So when stuff like that needs to get repaired, you need badasses working for you that can fix this stuff.
And we had them, Richie. Yeah. Some of those guys are incredible. The reason I even mention is because I look back and I say, well, everybody's in an email tether. You know, oh, we're going to do email. Well, listen, if you steal your identity off the email and the internet, who do you call?
Yeah.
No one.
Yep.
But they steal it from the mail. Who do you call? Postal inspectors.
Right.
There's nobody. They steal your identity. Who are you going to get in touch with? That's why I pray for someday that people get wise and say, look, some important documents, important information should go back to the mail. Hmm. Because that's who you can call. It doesn't really matter to me. It's not going to put any bread on my table because I retired and I am officially what's called a KMA.
What's that?
Kiss my ass. In other words, I can quit any day now and say, I should say I could retire any day now and that's it. I'm done. But I tell you the truth. I recommend to anybody listening to the podcast, if you got a kid that has an affinity for playing with stuff and learning how stuff works, let them do it. So what? My father was like, my grandpa used to say to mom, go ahead, let the boy do it. And I take their televisions apart, their toasters, you name it. You name it.
There's a story my dad tells me that you were, again, really young. So he was, how far are you apart in age?
8 years.
So he was 15, so you were 7.
Yeah.
So he was 15 and he just started playing guitar. Maybe he was a little older, I don't remember. He just started playing guitar and you handed him this contraption with a quarter-inch plug on the end of it, and you said, here, plug this in.
Wireless.
And he plugged it into his guitar,
right,
and he came out the radio.
That's right.
So you built a wireless guitar transmitter when you were like 7 or 8.
I was like, I took a few parts that I said, why can't this do this? I wonder if I play with this. I got zapped a million times as growing up as a kid, but it didn't scare me from it. Yeah, I did. But the pièce de résistance was this. Without your dad, I remember transmitting a video signal to my neighbor's house, telling him to put the television on channel 6, and I mooned him on television. So effectively, I was the first Wi-Fi cable transmitter. And these guys talk about that story forever. They said, I can't remember. They were all in their club at the time, and I said, put it on channel 6. And they put it on, and there was my bare ass. I tell you, we did a lot of crazy things growing up as a kid. It was a lot of fun. But I was definitely a geek. I mean, we all are geeks, man. I mean, that's why we're here. You know, we do this. We like to tinker with cool stuff. Richie, just looking around your studio, it's like amazing. I am amazed that the seed that I believe I helped plant in your head has grown into this.
There's not even a question about that. This is all because of. All right. Well, here I'll tell you. I've told the story before. I started getting interested in recording, and what I was doing is I was, you know, recording like so many people do. Well, not anymore.
Bouncing.
Yeah, so many people used to do when pre-computers. You record, a drum beat, and you playing acoustic guitar or something into the tape recorder.
Back and forth.
And then you play it through one tape deck, and you record on another tape recorder with you singing and playing bass, you know, and then you keep overdubbing that way, and it sounds like crap. But I started doing that, and you said, I have a 4-track recorder that you should just use.
Yes, yes.
So you gave me that, but there was only 3 tracks working on it. So I had a 3-track recorder. You couldn't fix that, could you? Yeah. Anyway, so
that was the beginning of digital, Richard. Yeah. Tripped me up then.
But then...
magnets.
Now, I have 2 cousins. My uncle has 2 kids. And when they got old enough to start putting their fingers and putting mashed potatoes in all of your gear...
Yes, that's 100% true.
You said to me...
That's true.
I have a 16-track reel-to-reel that I can't keep here anymore. And I'm going to keep it in your basement. And while it's there, you can use it as much as you like.
And that's it.
So but there was only 14 tracks working on that.
All the tracks work. It's the indicators didn't work. That was the problem on that one.
But... actually, there's a story that you probably remember, and I remember the first time I ever recorded was in your basement in Brooklyn. Now, let me give you a little background here. My uncle had a video rental store in Brooklyn, and it's probably one of the first video rental stores ever. Now, when did you open that store?
79. I was pretty much the first in Brooklyn.
So in 79, he had a VHS rental place, sort of at the birth of the whole right. home video thing. And but in the basement, he had a studio and a shop.
That's right.
So
you got a good memory, man.
There's two, and well, let me paint a picture here for our listeners, because this is very vivid in my imagination, but I want to paint the picture for everybody of what it was like around Bath Avenue in the 80s. On Bath Avenue in Bensonhurst, and this is in Brooklyn, there was, on one side of the street, Bath Music and Drum City. And both of those stores were owned by my grandparents. Bath Music had basically... Well, Drum City had all the drums, and my grandfather had a little shop in the back where he used to tinker with drum parts and stuff like that. And Bath Music had, it was a tiny little store packed to the gills with stuff.
That's right.
And there was gear overflowing from every corner of this place. Everywhere you turned, there were like little treasures. And that's not counting the stuff my grandfather didn't want people to see.
yep.
I told this story before. I really wanted a Rickenbacker when I was like 15 years old or something. And my dad said, "Why don't you ask your grandfather?" I said, "He doesn't have any nice guitars. He has all that crap on the wall."
Right?
So I woke up the next morning to four gorgeous Rickenbackers in my house with signs that said "Not for Richie" on them.
That's right.
Basically, my dad called my grandfather overnight because, "You got any Rickenbackers?" He goes, "Yeah," and he brought home four of them. Four.
That's right.
Four
That's right.
gorgeous ones.
That's he, right.
He didn't like it. Like tire kickers coming around and playing his nice guitars.
That's right.
So if you were a serious collector or someone who had cash, he'd be like, okay. And in his little treasure trove, he had like Gibson jazz boxes.
Oh shit! Yeah,
you know,
man.
Like stuff that's now like D'Angelico's.
Yeah.
Stuff that's now worth tens of thousands of
that's
dollars.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
You know, Rickenbackers, Fenders, like all like heavy duty vintage guitar stuff. He was very shrewd about
and
that.
They were away. They were put away, so they were even more ridiculous.
Yeah, they were put
mint.
Away. Well, I just remember like. You know, my grandmother saying, "Go in the back and get a can of tomatoes," and like
that's
and,
right.
And there'd be Gibson boxes everywhere,
lined up.
And I'd have to like move the like you know, oh here's
that's
a 335, here's a Lucille.
Right.
Okay, let me move this out of the way. Oh, here's your tomatoes,
still in the box.
That's right.
Yeah. So, so that was that store, and also in the back of that, just to paint a picture, they had the kitchen, which was like a kitchen that you could fit three people at the table comfortably, and she cooked for an entire neighborhood out of that kitchen.
Yes, that's right.
Yep.
They lived upstairs. And then across the street, in a similar layout, was my uncle's store. He had the video store on the main level.
Great memory.
In the basement, he had a shop with the studio and a repair shop. So Bath Music's repairs basically got outsourced to across the street.
That's
and
right.
It was directly across the street.
That's right.
It was like you can see. So both stores from the counter could see the other store.
That's right.
And then he lived above the store.
That's right.
So the first recording session I ever did, I remember this very vividly. It was.
By the way, you never paid for that session.
I know. It was
8 hours.
It was
$3.
It was Richie Valens. Come on, let's go. Because I was really into that. G. Well, come on, let's go, let's go, let's go, a little sweetheart. Tell me that you never need me. Come on, let's go again and again and again and again. So we start tracking this. He lays down his a Lin drum machine. He's laying down the drums, and he plays bass. Mm-hmm. And we didn't do any count. Basically, we just said boom, 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 and we're doing it. And I'm really excited. And then I realize, and I'm about to do my guitar part. And I go, "Oh wait, there's a pickup." You know, it goes right before that. Uh-huh. And he goes, "We can't do a pickup. You didn't tell me." He goes, "We need an extra measure of click." I said, well, how are we going to do this? He goes, "You can't." I said, okay. I lost interest. I canceled the session. We've been working on this song for like 2 hours.
By the way, you still don't have it right, you know.
I forgot there was a pickup to this song, you know.
Sorry, Keith.
Well, come on, let's go. That song. And he was like, "We can't do that now." I said, "Yeah, but can't you just no? It's you have to plan that ahead of time."
Lin drums were murder. Yeah. Oh my God. You had to put everything in it a certain way, man.
So I remember like the look of exasperation on your face. Like I said, "Yeah, we're done." if it's not going to be perfect, I don't want to do it. And I walked out.
Something's never changed.
That's
the same way.
That's an interesting comment coming from you.
And you were like, "Oh, what the hell?" So I remember that, and I'm going to tell one other story that doesn't really bode well for me, but I'm going to tell it anyway. My uncle had his whole place wired up, right? So he had cameras everywhere. So he invited my dad over one night to watch a big boxing match. So we're in my uncle's basement watching the boxing match, and I had to go to the bathroom. I said, I'm going to the bathroom. He said, okay. Now, to get to the bathroom, you had to walk to the porno section of the video store.
Yes.
So
I was wondering what took so long, Rich.
I must have been like curious. 7 or something like that, or 8. So I go upstairs. I think I'm scot-free right now, right? Yeah. You know, they're downstairs. So anyway, what's happening while I'm doing that, they're on the couch, even my dad, and my uncle goes, hey, watch this. He switches the TV from the fight to closed circuit cameras, and they look at me inspecting all the boxes in the porno section. And then I come back down, and they're dying. They're laughing at me. And my dad's like, see anything you like? You know?
a lot of giant peckers over there. You got unbelievable memory. God bless you, man. I'm really good.
I think it was like the first boobs I ever saw. Of course I remember.
I think all the Castellano men have good memory because you pick people's names out from 40 years ago that you haven't seen or spoken to. And
don't say that. Yeah, we haven't played the song. I don't even remember that.
No, just for names and breasts.
That's great, man. Great. I love reminiscing about stuff like that. It's unbelievable.
So you... Now, you repaired another thing that a few weeks back we had Bumblefoot on, and Danny Miranda was playing a bass that you actually restored. He was playing a Rickenbacker 4001S that when you sold that building, you found this bass in the corner of your shop in pieces.
That's right.
There was like a jar although that's something else I've heard about you, that there's bowls that...
Yes, sir, there is. Okay. There sure is.
Another thing you need to know about my uncle is that if he loses interest in a project in the middle, it ends up in a bowl.
That's right.
So TV's bowl. You know what I mean? Lawnmower bowl.
You know, that's really true because I was walking around my house the other day saying, oh, I never fixed that camera. Oh, I never did that. I said, oh, someday I'll get to it. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm 61 years old. There's no someday. In the trash. I'm not going to read that book. In the trash.
So this bass was in a bowl. For a long time.
The proverbial bowl, yeah.
And what happened was one of his customers wanted to put a large, like, soap bar style pickup in a Rickenbacker, and he routed out a slot for it. Now, Rickenbackers have very thin bodies, but he routed it out by using a drill and drilling about 100 holes. And when he drilled the 100th hole, the whole guitar snapped in half. Rickenbackers have neck through designs.
That's
it. Right.
We did this project for about 5 years.
Yeah.
And now the bass is together and it sounds awesome.
It's got a great sound. It plays well.
And I want to use this as a segue really quick to thank someone. This week, a Band Geek fan, John Johnston, gave me a really fantastic gift. He came to my Blue Oyster Cult gig in Texas, and he built me a replica of the USS Defiant from Star Trek Deep Space Nine as a bass guitar. It's unbelievable. It lights up. It has lighting the cells, light up phaser cannons. The frets light up.
Fantastic.
It's ridiculous. It's so awesome. I wanted to do a video with it last week, but I got sick. So I'm gonna do that soon, as soon as I get a little bit of time. So John, thank you for doing that, and thank you for listening, and thanks for your support.
It's a
very, very, very cool gift.
Class act.
And
how does it sound?
I haven't got a chance to plug it in yet.
Oh.
Well, look at it. It's going to sound great. It's got a jazz bass. It's got a jazz bass pickup on it.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? It's got to be great.
Yeah. It's awesome. And so I know Uncle Phil John has a CNC machine, which I know is something you it's on your wish list.
Yes, it is. It is. Computer numerically controlled. I like that stuff, man. It's geek stuff. It's all geek stuff.
So let's play a song. Now, the song that we've chosen, there were a lot. When I'm going to back this up again. I have so much I want to say since you're here. When I was like 7, when did Ferris Bueller come out?
86.
So, yeah, so 6 or 7, that's perfect time. I saw Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and I saw Twist and Shout from that whole the parade scene.
Yeah.
And I called him up. I called my uncle, who had like every single CD, which was like 40 at the time. I thought that was like every CD to me.
Everything.
You know? He has every song ever.
Ever made.
I said, can you make me a tape? And he said, yeah, what song do you want? I said, I want Twist and Shout, The Beatles. And he said, yeah. He goes, anything else you want? I said, no, that's it. He goes, but you know, any other Beatles songs? I said, well, I've heard of, I heard of I Want to Hold Your Hand, so I'd like that song. I heard of I Saw Her Standing There, so I like that song. And I've heard of She Loves You.
But I paid royalties for those, you know, I sent the check.
So I said, can you make me a tape with those? He goes, yeah, and I'm also going to put something else on that I want you to listen to. He put on Rubber Soul. Okay. So I had this tape that I wore out, which was those three things. That was, and now my dad liked the Beatles too, but that wasn't his go-to listening thing. He, you know, he'll listen to Motown, he'll listen to B.B. King, you know what I mean? He'll listen to like 70s funk or disco, you know, English rock. Basically, white people music is not my dad's jam.
But, no, definitely not.
But so I was being exposed to this. I said, wow, like, what's this? And my dad's like, this is the Beatles. It's like the greatest band of all time. Yeah. So he said, you know, I have some of these CDs if you want to hear them. So my dad, you know, gave me his Beatles CDs, and I got really into that.
They were brand new, Richie, because he probably never played them. So yeah. Still in the package,
still in the plastic. So I listened. So I got heavily into the Beatles for a few years, and then you said to me, "You know what your problem is?" And so I said, "What's my problem?" Uncle Phil? You only like music that you could dance to. I said, "What's wrong with that?" He goes, "You need music you can't dance to."
That's right.
He goes, "You need music you gotta sit there and listen to."
That's right.
I said, "Like what?" He goes, "Here," and he gave me Fragile by
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
And I
said, "Listen to that."
Fucking hated it. I said, "This album is terrible."
And dance to it. I just want to dance.
You know, there's no melodies I could remember.
I can dance to this. Yeah.
So I absolutely hated it, but I said, okay, Uncle Phil's telling me this is good, so I have to keep listening to it until I like it. And that's what I did. I kept listening to it. And then I remember one day I did a gig with my band, and the gig was so horrible. And I must have been like 13 or something. The gig was an awful, awful gig, and I felt bad about myself, and I felt like I failed. So as a punishment for myself, I went home and learned Heart of the Sunrise. I punished myself. I was like, I'm going to learn this whack-ass song that I hate, the long one for that CD Uncle Phil gave me. And I learned it. And as I was learning it, I'm like, I get why he likes this now. This is hard.
That's right.
Like, these guys, you know, I'm like, I don't think George Harrison could play this song. That's what I was thinking when I was learning Heart of the Sunrise. So I said, I get it now. I said, you know, when you get to a certain level of musicianship, you know, you could still like pop music and you could still appreciate it, but you want something that's going to challenge you. So as soon as I started getting into Yes, he went, oh, you like Yes? Here's Emerson, Lake & Palmer. Oh, you like Emerson, Lake & Palmer? Here's Genesis. So
that's right.
We're going to play a Genesis song now. He really got me into the album Foxtrot first.
That's right.
That was the first
Watcher of the Skies. Right. Yeah, excellent.
You know, walking across the sitting room.
That could be the next podcast if you want to do that.
Television of sitting beside you. Anyway. So
I didn't know you knew it. And Rich, I got to say something. What? I want to add to what you're talking about. My whole life, I always wanted to do these songs and play these songs in a band. Yes, Pink Floyd, Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Genesis. You know, I never did. I never reached that plateau where I could play them. Why? I was too comfortable and lazy. And I said,
you were making too much money.
I was making money. That's why. And then I got turned on to a guy years later, a guy named James Jamison.
Yeah,
and when I listened to him play, I said, "This guy's not using a pick, but he's making a great melody with his fingers." And he's so I said, "You know what? Between Squire and Jameson, I said, you learn those two and McCartney, you learn those three people. You don't need anybody else. You master those three things, and you got it down, baby."
We're gonna talk about bass playing after this, but first I want to talk about this song because there's a lot of stuff going on. We're gonna do "The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway," and this song's a pain in the ass. It's actually pretty straightforward as far as Genesis songs. I mean, early Genesis. There's no time changes in it really, but harmonically, this song is on another level. So, Andy, can you take us through what's going on quarterly? Because this is a really fun piano song.
I just know how to play it. I don't know how to explain it.
I don't know. Yeah,
it's the only thing that keeps time is the piano.
Am I skipping the intro? We'll just talk about like the chorus.
Brief.
Kind of
talk about the technique you're using in the intro.
So this is the Tony Banks two hand technique.
The Tony Banks Matrix.
So basically, you're playing like triads, and then you're playing another triad with your other hand on top of it, in between that.
So you keep on your left hand keeps playing the same triad.
See a bottle?
And you're and then you're playing two.
You're changing it.
So
yeah.
So just play the left hand part for a second. Now play the right hand part. No, just
no, just
the right
hand part.
Now combine them. That's so like classical sounding, you know what I mean?
It's the Legend of Zelda.
Oh, yeah. Like.
So what are those chords?
So this is like an E minor.
Yeah.
But then in in between the E minor, I'm playing like a D sharp and an F sharp. So that's that.
The harmonic
that's the
minor
classical,
sort of sound. Yeah.
That's it. And then I'm playing an E major, and then a D and F sharp.
So it makes it E dominant.
Yep. And
E9.
Yeah.
It's two.
Just sounds pretty when you play it and when I play it.
And then it does that the whole song, basically.
I
really?
See,
that's it?
Well, he has a wonderful economy with words.
This is what we deal
with. This is why I don't teach.
You have a wonderful economy with words.
First
of all.
All
right, so we'll just go. I'll just go to the structure of the song.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is basically E major.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm kind of doing E, G sharp, and then alternating it with F sharp and B.
Right.
And then it goes to G sharp minor.
Right.
And then an A. And then back to the E. And then flat to five.
Right, E flat five.
And then it's E flat. I go back to that alternating pattern thing. And then I go up to F sharp. And then B flat. And then this is actually like a A over B kind of thing.
Yeah.
After the B flat.
Right.
And then back to the E.
So I was trying to learn this today. The original recording is almost impossible to grab the guitar part off of. But you
hear like some sort of chorusy kind of
yes.
thing with a room echo.
I'm something. Probably going to put some echo and and effect on. No, I'm going to take the chorus off now. Just like that choice later.
There's definitely a texture. And also, once the song kicks in, it doesn't even sound like a piano. It's kind of like a synthy kind of thing.
Yeah, we're going to MIDI Andy so I could change his keys later and. And I'm the guitar part's very, very strange in this. It's like with like a delay. Early morning man at a, like that. Then we have the like the chords Andy just discussed. Let's try not to rush this because
rush, that's another one we
You lob that softball up so
don't
high.
Get me in the crazy directions here. I apologize.
Right before the band kicks in, the piano part slows down.
Yeah, so we have to anticipate.
So I'll kind of slow that down a little bit to get there.
All right.
You guys will hear it, I think.
Those guys.
Are you going to try taking one of these?
We're gonna turn the cameras on and do this. All right, here we go. Take it, Andy. Maestro. Is that rolling?
What is the first number? Number one.
Thank you. eyes down on Broadway. The lamp seems right out of place, yet the Broadway street scene finds a focus in its face. Somehow it's lying there, bring the stillness to the air. Though man may land, a night is very bright. There's no whitewashed victims, the neon's dim to the coat of white. Real Imperial aerosol kid wipes his gun, he's forgotten what he did. And the lamb lies down on Broadway. Susan tired, her work all done, thanks. Money, honey, beyond neon. Catman's velvet glove, South Horn. Just begun. Lord knows what I have done. And the lamb lies down on Broadway. On Broadway. On Broadway. On Broadway. Always magic in the air. On Broadway, on Broadway.
Yeah.
Woo!
That song's a pain in the ass.
That sounded pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun.
That was fun.
Genesis songs are always fun to play.
Oh my God.
First time?
Yeah.
Me too.
That's the first time ever playing that?
First time ever playing Genesis.
Ever any Genesis song?
First time.
Wow.
I'm like him, man. We went where the money was.
It's called the spaghetti and meatball.
I like it.
You play the drums, they eat the spaghetti and meatballs.
There's a Spanish expression I invented. It's called dinero primero. Money first.
Well, I mean,
it was a blast.
Yeah, that was a pleasure, and it was very cool. Let me tell you, it was cool playing that kind of music with the person that got me into that kind of music.
Uh-huh. Cool playing it, period. I enjoyed the shit out of it.
I just proved you all wrong, too, because I was dancing through that whole video.
Who got you into that music?
Teresa. And Teresa was turned on by him.
Right.
Now, who's Teresa?
My cousin Teresa. Favorite cousin in the whole world. Absolutely. I love this girl. And She left us too early.
Way too early.
Way too fucking.
You could curse. It's okay.
Way too fucking early. I'm not concerned. And wherever you are, I know you are right now. You got a smile from freaking ear to ear, right, Tino?
Hey, Richie. First time when I first met Teresa, she put on "Lamb Lies Down." The very first time.
So we're a result of that.
We sat down, and she had a Pioneer system, and she had a kick-ass stereo system. Her dad lives upstairs. Her dad came downstairs, she introduced us, and she turned on Genesis, and I says, "You like Genesis?" Wow, and so that was it.
Goes around, comes around, Richie, big circle here, Tom.
Yeah.
I want to point out something, that when we play the video, you might see it, but Muff was actually playing the kazoo. Show them what you were doing during that song, that was pretty impressive.
Amazing.
Because if you listen to the record, there's like a fly.
Oh yeah.
That's the most useful sounding thing you've done so far.
Nice.
That sounds the most like the record out of anything you've done so far. That most, fly sound.
Yeah. The most useful sounding
Muffy
thing
flies
today.
Down.
So, yeah, my dad just doesn't like this music, and that's okay. Not everybody has to like everything. But you were in his band, and his band was very successful and playing a lot of gigs and working. So it's hard to convince your wedding band to learn how to play Lamb Lies Down on Broadway when you're making too much damn money playing...
Yeah, but I did drive my band crazy because you know what my warm up lick was.
Oh, I do know what your warm up lick is, and please share it with us.
And he used to go nuts. Ah, oh, he's here again.
So when you heard, when did you start playing bass? What year?
I started playing bass in 61.
Okay, so you started playing bass 61. There was nothing. Really, no real influences in terms of electric bass at that point. You start on the upright?
My dad, on the upright. I remember standing on a chair playing his upright. And the first song I remember, I used to play like Kansas City, 145.
You any good on the upright?
I think I could be.
Which is the answer every musician gives.
I think I could be. It's going to just take a shitload of practice.
I'm going to tell a quick Buck Dharma anecdote that he told me once. We were sitting in the audience watching Deep Purple, and Steve Morse launches into this like amazing solo by himself, like just him, just beautiful and ripping. And Buck goes, "I could do that. I just don't feel like practicing that much."
That's about right. That's about right, yeah.
I can do that. That slayed me when he said that.
You know, when you're a young kid, it's like that proverbial biscuits in front of you, and you're always chasing it. You always want to reach out to that. And then you reach an equilibrium at a certain age. You say, fuck it, I'm not going to try to leave that. I'll just stay back. I like Lamb of Lies Down on Broadway. I said, wow, that's a great tune to do because it's only Mike Rutherford.
Yeah.
I mean, then I learned, I said, oh, this guy's playing his ass off. That was a great tune.
When you heard Chris Squire, obviously when you heard McCartney, that had to be an eye opener for on the bass, like
Mesa.
Well, I could play other notes that are in the chord, except for 1 and 5.
Yeah, that's true. McCartney was a genius with that stuff, and I got to tell you, when I heard Squire, I said, "Oh yeah, you got a different sound completely." And then I heard, like I said, the five guys that most influenced me, probably out of the three of them, was McCartney, had to be James Jamerson, and Squire. I mean.
Well, so when you were playing electric bass, when did you get your first electric bass?
Oh, gee, I think it was because the E and the B string broke. So I played four strings. Then Pop bought me a Zimgo. I was crying because...
Oh, you had a guitar first, you're saying?
Yeah, and okay. he bought both of us guitars, your father and myself, Zimgos. I cried because he bought him a guitar and he didn't bring me home.
Oh, wow.
And he went and he got me one the next day, and it was like, oh. Thank you very much. And I learned how to play chords. And then we got Hagstrom guitars. And Cousin Tommy, he had a Hagstrom guitar. We started learning that way. I said, you know what? But there's something more going on here. Then I played in a couple of different bands. I played in one band that is still around today. And we were like 13 years old at the time. You know them. Just Us.
Just Us.
I was me and Joey drummer. played with Joey in that band when he was a skinny kid.
Wow.
On West 9th Street at Teresa's house, the block party.
Just Us.
And they're still around today. They're a great band, but, you know, that's where we started. And
so you started with the electric, and you're playing with a pick. So when you picked up the bass, the natural thing was to play the pick for you with the bass?
Yeah, it was natural. You know what it was? I said, you know what, here's a lesson that could be learned. Anybody watching this podcast has to learn this lesson. If you want to play beautifully melodic, beautiful pieces and bebop and... Okay, that's great. Where's the pocket? Where's the bottom? There's more to be said for that. If you want to play beautiful melodic tones, beautiful ones, use your fingers. If you want to play absolutely percussive and on top of stuff and play right through it, use a pick.
Well, this is what we're getting at right now. There is a...
debate?
A big debate going on.
A mass debate.
Yes, a mass debate.
It's a mass debate.
And let's all mass debate together here.
Yeah,
and get to the bottom of this. So,
you just named this episode the mass debate.
I think the result will be coming quickly. So we'll be...
Oh, my God. You are the perfect guest for this show.
Slow clap.
The big debate is that some people think that you should only play bass with your fingers. That's sort of a purist thing. Although when the bass guitar was first introduced, it was absolutely play with a pick.
Absolutely.
Because it's a bass guitar.
That's right.
And then some people say, you know, some people only play with a pick. My bass teacher is my uncle, and he taught me do both.
And a double bass, you play with a bow.
Yeah. You play with a, right.
That's right. And that is about... and that is... This, there was about two other techniques.
Though. Violoncello.
Then the popping and slapping came in with Larry, Louis Johnson, and yep. He played a lot of that. And Victor Wooten. May his soul rest in peace, Louis Johnson.
Yep.
You turned a lot of us on to playing that funk, and you played it well, as good as it gets. You played it. And then there was John Entwistle, who did a lot of stuff, playing with his fingers.
Yep.
Another technique, right? And then you had Louis Johnson, and that is the third one on the horizon. And I like to think of it more like a country style, you know, where you're using.
Explain what you're doing because they can't see you.
It's a roll.
So he's doing like a rest stroke on the bass. Yeah.
Yeah.
Finger picking guitar style.
Yeah. But you're right. Like we talked about this years ago. You remember we did a video years ago? Your right hand, why you don't limit yourself with two fingers? You got three fingers, use them. You got a pick, use them. If the song calls for a percussive, if it calls for something that requires a lot of playing with a lot of tight 16s and 8s. Now, all you finger guys, I dare you to do this. Go ahead. Show me what your fingers are. Send me a tape.
I'll wait.
Send me a tape.
Oh, how about, why don't you do something like Squire? By the way, he was voted the best bass player in the world 5 years in a row. And he played with a pick, and he did Heart of the Sunrise. Do that with your fingers.
Well, you know what?
5 years.
Jeff Berlin did it. I gotta say, I'm not gonna play devil's advocate, but Jeff Berlin played on the Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, and Howe tour,
yeah.
And I'm like, oh, how the hell is Jeff Berlin gonna do this? But he played all that shit with his fingers. So, but look, if you wanna,
did you see him do it live? Because you know what, I gave him my bass to play, and he played my eight string with a pick.
Yeah,
he used the pick, but he didn't expound on it. He just said, yeah, I could use that. So you never know what trick was used.
Look, it's. It's not about, the point is...
Jeff is a great player, by the way.
The point is not that you do what the song calls for.
That's right.
You do what you're supposed to do.
That's precisely.
The, and I think the bass is like such a dynamic instrument that you could get so many different colors.
Absolutely. If you're you could
get different colors playing with the pick. You could play hard, you could play muted, you could, you know,
yeah,
do that.
Absolutely.
With your fingers, you could play hard, you could play soft.
There is a tell,
against the neck.
Sorry to interrupt, but there's a tell. The tell is the direction of the movement of the right hand. If it's coming up, chances are it's your fingers. Right?
Right.
If it's coming down, chances are it's a pick.
But there's a lot of... I'm sorry, go on, Andy.
Isn't that a thing that Paul McCartney is a up picker or something like
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
Maybe.
He is. Yeah.
Instead of a down picker.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Will Lee, same thing. Will Lee's an up picker.
Yeah,
you see,
I've seen him do that.
He picks up. Well, he's limiting himself to 50% of what he could do. Because if you go up and down, you get you're I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. It worked for me.
Look, we had Al Cardi here a couple weeks ago. Al is the bass player for Alicia Keys.
He's great,
and Rob Thomas. And I've never seen him play with a pick because I've never played rock with him before. We did a few rock tunes. He picked the pick up and played. I'm like,
yeah.
Because you know what? Because that's what you're supposed to do.
That's right.
This debate is not a debate. This is sort of an old school, like, why are you playing with your pick? But if the song's got to be percussive, and it needs a certain sort of attack and a little growl to it,
that's
you play with a pick. If it needs that little pop, you slap. If it needs to have a warm, you know, thumpy sort of sound, you play with your fingers.
And there are no rules.
There are no
rules.
So you
can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of songs that... that are played with a pick that people don't realize.
That's right.
The one that I'm pretty sure that it was played with a pick that people don't realize is I Want You Back. Yeah, I think that's a pick.
Yep. It is with a pick.
Yeah. Wilton Felder, the saxophone player, played that song on bass. That's not Jamerson, by the way.
No.
Yeah. Yep. Now, right now, my uncle's bass doesn't sound like it because, he has round wound strings.
Right.
If you play... pick with a flat wound
amazing.
String, it sounds, you get the Motown
and
sound.
It could also could be a felt pick, too.
And you look, yeah. James
well,
Jamerson.
His name was Felder, so maybe he did use a felt.
But did Bobby Babbitt, I believe, play that at Motown? He played with a pick, too, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, Carol Kaye played
Carol,
with a pick, yeah.
And she's, it's Carol Kaye. You can't really count Carol Kaye. She only recorded 1,000 hit records. and James Jamerson recorded an equal amount with his fingers, mixed up with Bobby Babbitt, who played a pick, and McCartney, who played on 400 records with a pick.
There's no right or wrong.
There's no right or wrong. Anybody who thinks there's right or wrong, they need their heads examined.
I, you know, I, when I, started playing at Blue Oyster Cult, I learned all the songs with my fingers, and I didn't have the calluses developed in the right way because I'm a pick player primarily, unless it really calls for it. And I was playing my fingers, and we're rehearsing, and Buck comes up to me and he says, "Can you play with a pick?" I was like, "Yes, yes, I can play with a pick."
just for you, just because you asked.
I was like, "Hold on, let me just wipe the blood off my fingertips, and then I'll pick up the pick and I'll finish this."
It's like that. You know, some guys, they migrate to what they learned as a kid. When they were kids and they learned how to play with their fingers, they think, well, because I can do that. I'm like excellent. I can like, oh, you're only using a pick. That doesn't really count. Well, here's the pick.
And another thing is, no disrespect to people who only play with their fingers. Seriously.
Different style.
No disrespect. And people who could get those, like, you know, Rudy or a guy like Steve Harris, they can play with their... I mean, and by Rudy, I mean Rudy Sarzo. They can play with their fingers and get that sort of picky attack with the way they set their amps
action
up.
Action, also.
And that's fine. And no disrespect to them. But I think it's time to put this, don't play with the pick thing to bed. I think that's done.
You know what we also did? You and
I
did
start this. Hanging out with different people.
I'm hanging
main,
out with,
main
a,
conversation.
With a bunch of 70-year-olds.
when we were doing this, remember, you and I, we stumbled across this. We were doing, now, I'm playing with a pick. We migrated the two. We put the two of them together, and we came up with a hybrid pick. I mean, whatever it takes to get you over the song. I mean, that's a very important aspect of it all.
So, Uncle Phil mentioned before that he worked for the post office. What happened is when he had to go get trained to do that, and it's very involved postal training.
Yeah.
It's not just wearing funny shorts. You have to go. It's really in depth. And they make you go to, where was it, Oklahoma?
Oklahoma, yeah.
You have to go to their central headquarters in Oklahoma and go there for a month.
Sometimes a month, yeah.
And live there and learn every day
to
work on these machines.
I was a good boy.
So he did that, but the problem is my dad's wedding band had gigs. And my dad...
That's right, I forgot that.
Flipped out. You're gonna miss four jobs. You know what I mean?
I flew home for the weekend.
No, you did not fly home for the weekend.
Oh, you played.
Yes.
Yes. I flew a different time I flew home.
And
you played for Barbara.
You went. Yeah, I did. You said, make Richie do it. And he's like, my dad was like, he's 15. He can't do it. And you said, you don't know your own son. You don't know your own son. He could do this. And for like 2 months... I sat down. I went to weddings with him. I sat down next to his bass cabinet with a tape recorder.
I love him.
And I sat there.
I love him.
And I learned every song in their set. I wrote everything down.
Three chords. On a notebook. Everything.
No. And then I played everything back for you, and you said, "No, you learned my mistakes." He said, "You could do about half of that." Said, you play. You're like, I play that many notes. You can do about half of those notes, you'll be okay.
Just do every other one, it'll be fine.
So, you know, 15, 16 years old, I played my first wedding because you had a, and that,
that's,
you know,
true.
I learned bass on a sort of a superficial level, like, oh, I'm playing a song that goes like this. So the bass is, you know what I mean?
Right.
But when I actually had to sit down with my uncle and learn how to use the instrument, that was when I finally started doing it, and I considered myself a bass player because,
right,
like, wait, this is, I'm not just playing roots anymore. I have to play bass lines with my pick, with my fingers.
That's
I have to slap on
That's
disco
right.
songs.
Right.
You know, I have bass solos in the middle of the set. Like, I have, you know, there's all these little R&B and...
Yeah.
And it's all got to be in the pocket.
And every... Here's something. Don't tell nobody I'm about to say this. Keep this amongst us. Every guitar player thinks they can play bass. Would you agree?
That's a secret.
don't say nothing to nobody. If I could play on six strings, I could do it on four. Oh, hello.
It depends on what you're playing. There's some truth to that. If you're going to join a punk band, you could probably do a convincing, because it's the same thing pretty much, but it depends on what you're doing. But that's how I got into playing weddings, and I've never stopped playing weddings. even now, I'll come home from a gig with Blue Oyster Cult, and I'll go do a wedding. I mean, why not?
You know I asked Willie Sutton one time. They asked him, "Hey Willie, why do you rob banks?" And you know what he said? That's where the money is. If the money's in wedding, if I told you wear your purple hair and you're gonna get an extra $300 a night, You're going to wear purple freaking hair. You're going to go do the job.
You want to hear a funny story that Danny Miranda told me? He said he was on tour with Queen, and they just played Nassau Coliseum. And then I think they had like a rehearsal the night before or something. And Danny's like, okay, I'm going to go. I have a gig at the Red Lion.
Oh, I
so
love
he's
it.
So he's playing the Nassau Coliseum one night, then the Red Lion. And Roger Taylor, the drummer from Queen, said, need a drummer? And he was serious.
Right.
Because it's not about the stature of the gig or how cool the gig is. Yeah. It's we're musicians. We play.
That's right.
We play all the time. It doesn't matter where we play. It doesn't matter what we play. We play. It's what we do.
That's right.
And that's
right.
And absolutely. That's the lesson from that.
No small gigs.
Yeah. The lesson from that is also the truth of the matter is how many times you come home after a job and the only thing you find comfort in doing is sitting down playing a guitar. You know, or picking up an instrument. Like, I'll go home, and I don't play guitar, but I will sit home, and I'll pick up my nylon guitar. For 2 hours, I'll play nylon guitar. After I spend the whole night wearing my fingers out. It's something that we do, and like you say, Richie, you do it because you love it. If you didn't love it, you wouldn't have got started, and you wouldn't have went all the way that you did. I mean, everybody around us here is the same way. And I recommend that anybody, if you fall in love with your instrument, learn how to do other things that'll complement your ability at your first instrument. Learn another instrument. Learn something else.
We're going to shift gears for a second because I want to talk about another really interesting facet of your life. And this is acting.
Oh, no. This is a different union, you know.
This
is Screen Actors Guild, you know. The other ones are 802, we don't care. But Screen Actors Guild, that's another story. I never...
Well, what made you know, what made you think you could act, first of all? And can you?
I have been told by lots of friends of mine. He said, my friend Johnny Mac told me, he says, when you tell me you're an actor and I hear how you handle people, I got to believe you're very good. Because... You sling some deep bullshit. I said, thank you, John. It's a compliment.
Well, so what made you want to do that?
What happened is, I like to call him my Uncle Frankie Adonis, because I pretty much grew up under his wing.
Cheech.
Frankie Adonis. He's a great little actor, and he's a great guy. And he called me one time. He says, listen, they're doing a movie called Goodfellas. This is a good story. They're doing a movie called...
Goodfellas was your first one?
Yeah, doing a movie called...
What?
He called me up and says...
How do you not know this?
He said, you're doing a movie called Goodfellas, and they need lots of extras. You make $40 for the day. So, I can act. I can do this. Hawk, I hear the cannons roar. No. So, this is the number you call for the casting director, Sylvia Faye Casting. I'll never forget. She was a great lady. She did a lot. And I call her up, and she says, okay, you got to be there at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning on the humidity address. And she says, you're anything from the 70s? I said, yes. As a matter of fact, they do. I believe I have an old 1970s tuxedo. I don't want to tell her that was the one I played the wedding jobs with every weekend. So I went there with my suit in hand and my ruffled shirt and my jacket on. I went there with my ruffle shirt and jacket on, and I sat in the bus all day long. And Marty Scorsese was lining up a very important shot that required lots of extras at the Copacabana. So as he's putting the actors, there's principal actors, there's day players, and there's extras, and there's silent bits at the time. So as he's lining up, he's miscounts, and he says, oops, I'm missing an actor. I need one actor here at the doorway. And the assistant director says, it'll take a long time to get him in costume and get him. And one of the other assistant directors says, we got an extra on the bus wearing a tuxedo. So they come and get me off. Oh, you, Mr. Castle. It's my name, by the way, Castle. That's my film noir. That's nom de film. El film de nome. So they bring me, I'm very animated with my hands. I apologize for that. I may be smacking the microphones. So I leave my, and I'm like nervous. Can you believe I was nervous? The coolest guy in the world was nervous. So I was very nervous, and I go there, and they line me up by the door at the Copacabana. And he's got everybody. He was ready to shoot it. I'm a non-union, $40 a day extra. And they line me up by the door, and I'm thinking, oh, I hope I don't screw this up. Oh,
this
please.
Is your first gig.
Oh, my first gig.
Your first gig, Mark Scorsese.
Son of a bitch.
And Marty. And Marty's long.
Oh, Marty. Marty.
My buddy Marty. MS. MS is walking. No, Marty Scorsese is walking down the, taking the camera through the rehearsals, and he gets up to me and he says, Ray Liotta walks to the door, and you recognize him, you let him in. So, Ray Liotta, who the fuck? I say, hi, Ray. Oh, no, the character's name is Henry Hill. Okay, next take, comes around. Ray Liotta reaches his pocket, hands me 20. Oh, Philly, what are you doing? I say, hey, thanks a lot, Henry. I tell him. They do it, they do it again, they do it about 10 times.
Was that, now, I know the shot you're talking about. I'm sure a lot of people have seen Goodfellas.
There's
a famous shot in that movie, which at that point was the longest single camera shot in history.
Steadicam.
Steadicam. Moving through the club. So it starts off outside the Copacabana. It goes inside. And the first, and it follows Ray Liotta and his girlfriend.
That's right.
And the first person he sees, now all the punters are going through the front door of the Copacabana.
That's right, right.
And Ray Liotta's character, Henry, goes to the side door, and then to where the big shots go. And the first person who opens the side door is Uncle Phil, who's in a tuxedo. So when you watch that movie again, the fellow you see there is my uncle. Now
the good fellow you see there.
Yes.
When he looked at me and he asked me if I wanted to dance.
So that shot goes from the front door all the way through the club. There's people walking in front of the camera. It is a heavily choreographed shot. It's like Birdman, but you know, just
the one
shot from Birdman. But that's the idea. So what happened there?
What happened next was they shot it about. They spent the whole day there. Oh, 3 hours, 2 hours. I'm lying. I'm exaggerating. Don't do that. Okay, so. So then they come up to me and they say, okay, great. It's a cut. We'll wrap this scene. We'll move on. And the assistant director comes up and says, I need your, you forgot to put your union number on the card.
Now, why did you have to put your union number on?
Because in order to have a line in a movie, you had to have be in
the
union.
But you didn't have a line in the movie.
A homina, they have a guy drives a tail. So says to me, you didn't put your union number. I says, I'm sorry, but I'm not in the union. He goes, oh shit. So he right away they had to draw up a contract and give me a contract.
But you're leaving something out. They pulled him in for a non-speaking role.
That's right.
But he improvised the line, how you doing, Henry?
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Yes. If you get a chance to talk.
So he, because he improvised that line.
Oh, and, I forgot
and,
about that.
And it worked. Because obviously the director who's watching this heavily choreographed scene says, hey, it looks good. You know what I mean? Didn't stop him. Because if he really fucked the scene up and he wasn't supposed to do that, they would have said, cut, you, don't talk. Right. You know what I mean? And they would have done it again.
Yeah. It looked natural.
They kept it. So after the fact, they go, oh, you spoke. Okay, no problem. Just put your SAG stuff here. And he went,
I have no union number. Hey, did you like that segue? See, I can tell you.
Acting.
Hawk, I hear the cannons roar. No. So, as he said, oh shit, he runs right away, comes back with a union contract.
Yeah.
Now, in order to get in the union, you had to have a contract. But in order to get a contract, you had to be in the union.
That's one of the catch-22s of SAG.
Absolutely.
And the musicians' union.
So what happens is, Natty gave me the contract. The very next day, I went to Manhattan with my contract in my hand and my checkbook, and I said, I would like to join the Screen Actors Guild. So I joined the Screen Actors Guild, but I did about 100 TV shows or movies.
Okay, let's rapid fire here.
Not a one of them you're going to see me in, but I made a lot of money.
No. You, tell the audience where they could see you. So what movies?
I did. I got one line in a movie called Billy Bathgate. I got a line. I got another line in a couple other TV shows.
I remember being on vacation and there was a
State of Grace,
a rerun of the Cosby Show on.
Oh, I was a cab driver in the Cosby Show.
And I remember in the back, like
that was me.
There was two people having a cup of coffee, and
that's
Uncle Phil. And I always see it.
That's right.
One of my favorite cameos of not cameos, but extra bits that you did was Men in Black.
Mm-hmm. I loved doing that movie. That was a fun.
Are you with the hot dog vendor?
Hot dog vendor in the last scene.
When he lifts the paper, right?
He lifts the paper.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? I could do this. I like doing this stuff. Are you kidding? Then again, I also auditioned for some really heavyweight stuff, too. I almost got the role in several things. I was the Money Store guy. I replaced Phil Rizzuto for like 6 months.
Really?
On a TV show.
Yeah.
You know what? Bob, you have extra money after payday? I can't believe that. But like I said, it's all about money. If you make money, it's good. If you don't make money, you got to try a little harder to find something else going to make
you
bucks.
So what other TV shows or movies do you think that people would like see?
Like I said, this is another trick I would like to teach everybody right now. Segway. Ready? The trick is this. If you're going to be an extra in a movie, try not to be seen. They make you come back the next day. And I would do 5-6 days on a movie when other guys would do one.
Yeah.
Because I would be deep background. They'd say, where are you going? I was the deep background. All right, come back tomorrow.
Yeah.
Where were you today? I was deep background. All right, come back another day.
Yeah.
So, some guys couldn't get one day. I ended up getting 4 or 5 days in a row.
And also, people get cut from movies. Like Muff gets cut from all the movies that he's in.
Dude, I was... That's I was, I was, I was cut. I was cut from She-Devil. I was cut from... I did
with
a nice
Roseanne Barr.
I did a nice bit in Fisher King with Robin Williams, and I got cut out of that one.
Who is now? When Jarrett supposedly was in The Dark Knight,
I think you read that wrong. He meant to say he bought the movie.
Jarrett was in The Dark Knight. He was on set. He got to see Christian Bale in the suit, and he had a really great conversation with Gary Oldman, and he said was one of the coolest guys. Gary Oldman.
I work State of Grace with Gary Oldman.
So he
is the coolest guy.
He's the coolest favorite, guy. Who are your favorite actors that you got to meet on the set?
F. Murray Abraham.
Really?
I worked with him on Bonfire at Vanities, the second longest shot, steady cam shot. And he was nice, he was funny, he was clowning around. He was a down to earth kind of guy.
But he killed Mozart.
Yeah, terrible. I never forgave Salieri for that.
Now you also met Patrick Stewart, right?
Patrick Stewart is the personification of a professional, really gifted, quality
Starfleet
actor.
Captain. Yeah.
Absolutely. I should have went that way, Richie. He is a good, he's an excellent Starfleet captain. And he was a really nice guy. And he told me, he says, yeah, I'm going to be doing Shakespeare in the park. I said, I love the park. I said, Shakespeare in the park. Which park are we talking about? Central Park. I'm doing it in Central Park. And I said, I gotta come see you. I never went there, but I told you, he was a nice guy.
Did he blow up Patrick Stewart? Is that what's happening?
Yeah. The time Uncle Phil blew up Captain Picard.
Actually, what happened is I did a movie with him and Elliot Gould and a bunch of people. I was like a stand-in for somebody, but we got to hang out with everybody, play cards and bullshit. And He always had these mavens around him breaking his chops about movies and Star Trek and shit. And he knew I had a video store. Patrick Stewart knew I had a video store. So one guy was hounding him, and he looked at the guy and says, why don't you talk to Phil? He can get you the movies.
That's awesome.
And I said, Pat, I didn't say Mr. Pat. I said, Patrick, do me a favor. I said, Patrick, do me a favor. I never do this. Please forgive me. But you, I would like a picture with. He says, of course. And he was very, very nice about it. Excuse me. He probably was my favorite out of everybody I worked with.
And then he came to the video store, and you and your brother took closed circuit video of him in the adult film section.
I got rehired immediately.
Can I segue? I tried Uncle Phil's trick, the talking trick, because I knew that thing from Goodfellas when I was in Chicago. And when I did Fred Claus, it worked. Because they sent me a union contract because I talked to Vince Vaughn.
There you go, buddy.
In the truck. However, I also crashed that truck.
Oh, shit.
On set?
No. How to win friends and influence people.
And that kind of got rid of my that part of the film.
Yeah. Well, I did a movie with do you remember the movie The Bodyguard? She had a big bodyguard that with his name was Mike Starr. He was a friend. He's a great guy, talented actor. Nice guy. We're doing a movie called The Delicatessen. And now Mike's the principal character in the movie, and he's trying to throw me a bone and throw me a line so I can make extra money. So, Philly, I'm going to cut this up, and I'm going to ask you something. You're going to say working on it. Philly, it's up there. You ready? Working on it. Cut. The director, you don't say anything.
Oh.
You
tell me.
But that's, sometimes it works. Acting is fun. The trouble is that most of the actors you see today, they're posers. They have a great look, but can they act? Acting is, you look at some people have the gift is great at what they do. Like, who would have hired Orson Welles to be an actor if based on how he looks by today's standards? I don't think he would have did it. Humphrey Bogart, I don't know. With that bad wrist that he had, you know, that sound. I don't know if they were hiring a sweetheart.
I also want to point out, too, that you mentioned before that this was all called because of Uncle Cheech.
Uncle Cheech. We call him Cheech, but his name that he goes under when he acts is he's done a lot of great stuff.
And if you go back and watch Goodfellas, Frank is sitting next to Ray Liotta one of the most famous scenes.
Yeah.
Why am I funny?
And then he's also one of the bad guys in Ace Ventura.
Oh yeah, he's right. Steal the dolphin.
Mm-hmm.
He lived next door to so actually, let me paint a better picture. There was Bath Music,
True Romance too.
Bath Music, Drum City, and Uncle Cheech's apartment. That was all. That's Bath Avenue. Yep. So he was my grandmother's next door neighbor.
That's right.
So it's all sort of connected.
Amazing artist too, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
What people don't know about him, you may not even know this, and you're pretty well knowledgeable about this. He was a cartoonist back in the 50s and 60s. Hmm. He drew Snuffy Smith, Barney Google, Casper the Friendly Ghost.
Really?
He worked for Paramount Pictures.
I did not know that.
He was one of the artists. He was an amazing artist.
Derek's nerd ears just perked up.
You know what? Frank was one of the first movie stars that I met because we house sat for your sister and we were hanging out in front of your grandparents' store across the street from the video store eating L&B, and then he showed up and I was like, that's the guy from my TV.
That's right. That's a lot of good stuff. I hope he's doing some other stuff. He's got his kids involved. I hope he hits a home run because he's a good guy. He's been working a very, very long time in the industry.
I flipped out because he became a meme. They had like a meme.
Oh, really?
Of Joe Pesci and Ray Liotta and Frank is like in like this like for the older audience, a meme
is a still picture.
Well, no, actually, a meme's got a very strange. Actually, I'm an old person now because a meme's hard to define. A meme's like a cultural. It's something that picks up cultural attract. It's like a viral piece of media or something or a concept or a phrase. But I saw a meme picture, which was like the still shot from Goodfellas. And I think the caption was like, and then she said, why do you need more guitars? You know what I mean? And it was like that. And then it was Frank. I said, and I sent it to his son on Facebook. I'm like, your dad's a meme. That's awesome. So while you're acting, you're fixing guitars, you're renting VHS tapes.
Yes.
And
I was responsible. I was responsible for many babies getting born. You know, I was the only guy renting porno movies at the time. Yeah, guys would come to me, this is no good. I had a Chinese guy used to come. I had a Chinese guy used to come to me at like 12 o'clock in the afternoon and rent 5 porno movies. Come back an hour later and return them. Wait a second. Wait, let me get this straight. You watched all 5 of them in an hour? I don't think so. But I had to wipe off the movies every time he brought them back in.
Oh. Are you allowed to tell us that? Isn't there a video store clerk customer confidentiality?
It's the video code. Listen, I can't mention his name, but it sounded like a bunch of like
a wok falling on the floor.
No, it's I'm not. Walk.
Yep, there we go.
So you were telling
us you got the part in Goodfellas because you had a tuxedo that you played gigs in.
Yeah.
Basically.
That's right.
So everyone, go out and get a tuxedo.
Just remember this. Luck is when preparation meets opportunity.
Oh.
Let's play again because...
Since we're talking about tuxedos.
Okay.
You had to say the walk thing. That's what the problem was.
So... Obviously, you didn't get to play your Pink Floyd or your Genesis with my dad's band.
I have reached Zen. Yeah, Ratino, we've achieved Zen. Yeah, we got to do it at least.
Well, what songs now? Out of all that, now you said you sort of took a liking to James Jamerson and a lot of that R&B and funk stuff and disco.
Yeah.
What songs do you like playing? What's like your favorite song to play with my dad's band?
I always liked. I used to like You Can Call Me Al, but as I got older and my hands stopped working, I stopped liking that. Now I enjoy stuff like Shake Your Body and stuff like that. Simple stuff. Nice bass line with a nice deep hook. And, you know, you can let your head down. Well, that's a good tune, but, you know, that's a seeing playing tune. That's an okay tune. But as far as playing, it's like, again, you can play with a pick, you can play with your fingers. Depends on how you like
it. Do you still sing that song?
Which one?
Late in the Evening?
Yeah, I used to do it. I still do it. Yeah. I can't do it. I haven't done it in years.
Okay. Let's do one more song, and this song is probably my favorite song from my dad's band, and it was so, I love this song so much. when it comes on, no matter where I am or what I'm doing, I will dance like a fool. It doesn't matter.
It's totally true. It's totally true.
And we're going to do this. The song in question is Give It To Me, Baby by Richard James.
Motherfucker, I'm Rick James.
I'm Richard Jim.
I'm Rick James, goddamn.
Let's try to roll it again.
Okay.
Like, for real this time, though.
Well, Jared's wearing sunglasses today, Band Geek people, because he had his cataracts removed. And
it's not a Rankin Continental.
No, it's because I'm from the future.
Right.
This is it.
This is it.
Oh.
Get your space eyes out of here. And your hamburger headphones.
Oh, I forgot about that.
I'm just a joke to you people. I'm just your foil.
Now, I love this song so much, and my dad knows I love this song. So, at our wedding, when not my, my dad's wedding, but Anne-Marie and my wedding.
You weren't there for your dad's
wedding. Yeah, I wasn't there for that. He made sure that he did that song, and Tino was there, and his whole band was there pretty much. And they basically hijacked the bandstand and they did this song, and it was probably the highlight of the
night.
Aside from getting married, it was probably the highlight of my
night. Oh, there were a lot of highlights.
All right, I had pizza.
The wedding night should have been the highlight, Richie.
So people might not hear me. But, Richie, you have to do lead dancing on this.
Lead dancing?
Yeah, you have to get in the middle and dance. I know you won't be able to help it. You're going to do it anyway.
I'll groove in my chair.
No, you need to bust a move.
I already danced to Genesis. He doesn't need to.
Yeah.
He's not going to be able to
do the impossible. Now, the original's in D, but I'm going to do it in C just because that's the key my dad's band does it in, and that's the only key I know it in. So. You're trying to sing like Rick James?
When I came home last night.
That's Kermit James.
Oh, Kermit James.
Kermit James. Kermit James.
Kermit James.
That's Kermit James.
Okay, so Jarrett. You're going to be doing the horns.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
let's see what that sounds like. You know, if you close your eyes, that sounds just like someone playing kazoo badly. But that'll be fine.
Wow.
No, if
just because I can't see you because I'm blind doesn't mean I'm deaf, Richard.
No, we'll Andy and I will do the beef up Muff's kazoo with some synthesizer horns afterwards.
No. Wow. This is Richie's thing. He makes you feel important while you're doing it and then changes later.
Yeah, that's great.
It's called a bait and switch.
It's called Richie's lovemaking.
We're just
going to
jam.
Why is Muff saying that?
Richie's lovemaking.
We're just going to jam, right?
I hope so.
Oh, yeah. I could jam on this.
Oh.
Say what?
I got sound. It.
That's a jamming.
That's a jam sound.
Jamming on the one.
Oh, so guitar players, soloists, instrumentalists. If you'd like to solo over this, Andy, what are the two chords in this pretty much?
C minor and F.
Okay, little band geek knowledge here I'm going to lay on you. When you're playing a song and the one chord is minor, so C is the one. 4
E-flat.
Is F, so C, D, E, flat, F. That's the 4, and it's major. That is a dead giveaway that you are in the Dorian scale. Dorian scale, if you don't want to learn a new scale, you don't have to, because it's a mode. So you take, if you know a minor scale, all you do is you go up a fifth, so in this case, G. So Andy, play me a C minor 7 chord. So here's a C minor scale over that. Doesn't sound too great. But now, here is a G minor scale over that. Oh, whoops, sorry. And G minor is the same as C Dorian. Now, if you don't know how to play a minor scale, that's fine. Yeah, go practice, though. You can play a B flat major scale, and that's the same thing.
That's what I was waiting for. Dorian.
The headphones went out.
Your cans went out?
Cans went out.
Are really? You sitting on the cord?
No, they were on a minute ago. So did you two... Oh, there you go.
Oh, you got that key?
Sabotage!
All right. Now, this is one of those songs that I do live, and I'm sort of in the moment, and I'm dancing, and I don't actually know if I do this song well. I think I do this song well.
You sure danced the crap out of it, though.
Thanks, honey. Anne-Marie's joining us. She was had a recording session today.
What are you in? What are you asking for there, Anne-Marie?
When he's having such a good time, we can't really tell him. We actually think.
Well, he's a terrible dancer. I'm just, you know.
I'm an excellent dancer. Wow. I am excellent.
And I'm an excellent driver.
Horrific dancer.
Drove out of the driveway.
So,
someone who has such good rhythm, you sure don't know how to move your feet.
Yes.
How far do you want to go?
Let's see what happens.
We can go pretty far.
All the way.
I'm a little nervous about what this is going to sound like. I'm going to be honest. I'm not going to lie. But
I will be happy to demonstrate the three techniques of the bass guitar in this record. I will show you playing with the pick, playing with the fingers, and playing with the slap. Okay.
How could you slap?
I will slap the bass a little bit.
Okay. Shit. Let's do it. Nice and bright, please. 1, 2, 3, 4.
I just wanna love you, baby.
I guess that's why I'm so elated. Come on, girl, give it to me, baby. Give it to me, baby. Give it to me, baby. I made you holler, you had enough. Give it to me, baby. I make you holler, you're heading down. Give it to me.
Give me that stuff, that funk, that
say
sweet, that funky stuff.
Give it to me.
Give me that stuff, that funk, that sweet,
what?
That funky stuff.
Give it to me, give it to me. Give it to me, give it to me. Give it to stuff, that sweet,
funky stuff.
Oh, wow!
man. Muff, what do you got? You got the moves. That's one thing you got. All right. Thank you very much for listening to Band Geek. I'm Richie Castellano.
And we gave it to you.
That's right.
How'd you like it?
Our special guests today were Tino Cacciola. And my Uncle Phil Castellano. Joining us today were Brandy Metaxas.
Hello.
The latecomer, Anne-Marie Castellano.
Hi, guys.
On keyboards, Andy Ascalise. Killing it on kazoo and slide whistle today. And sunglasses, Jarrett Pressman. Jarrett Shades Pressman.
Stay cool, baby.
You got it, Jarrett.
I'm Richie Castellano. Thanks for listening to Band Geek. See you next time.